Welcome back to another episode of the Beer Truth Podcast. I'm Tom, and we're back to Beer Basics this week. Hopefully we'll have another interview next week, working on getting several different ones set up, so hopefully that will come together. But right now, there's a lot of stuff going on. If you don't know, like half of the state of California is on fire, so that's kind of been on a lot of people's minds, and I know a lot of people that are listening to this right now are probably not too far from fires right now, so stay safe. I am personally very close to some fires right now that are not under control yet, so yeah, the whole world's on fire, and this is just the most recent physical version of that. So, well, I guess the whole world's not on fire. America's on fire. Yeah, America's definitely on fire. But anyway, today what I'm going to talk about is the Reinheitsgebot, which, if you don't know, is the German beer purity law that, you know, a lot of people think it's just, you know, you can brew with water, malt, hops, and yeast. There's more to it than that. There used to be more to it and then less to it and different things along the way. So I thought we'd get into that one as we're kind of headed towards Oktoberfest here. So hint, hint, maybe that's the next one. But this one, talking about the Reinheitsgebot, what it is, you know, what it means now, what it has meant along the way, and kind of how we got to that point and where it's gotten to now. So it's the original Bavarian beer purity law. And I say Bavarian because this was back before Germany was a, you know, one united country. There was different areas, different fractions. It said that beer could only be made with barley, hops, and water. And yeast was not included. And there are several theories on that, but it's not because they didn't know what yeast was. They knew, at least in some degree, that yeast played a role in beer making. The theory I've seen most is that Duke Wilhelm IV, who signed this into law originally, didn't consider yeast to be an ingredient because he considered it something that didn't stay in the beer once the beer was produced, which is probably not true in of itself, but there are different theories on why yeast was not included, but they did know at least to a good degree that yeast was, maybe not, you know, the scientific processes, but that it was a part of beer and how beer got made, how it got to, you know, its end product. So, like I said, it was the Reinheitsgebot was signed into law by Duke Wilhelm IV, and it was part of the Land Ordinance of Upper and Lower Bavaria from 1516. And it was much more than just a law about beer. It was actually a big law book that was codifying laws because various parts of Bavaria merged and needed some kind of cohesion when it came to laws, you know, keeping things together, bringing different people and different practices together and creating a set of laws that could be passed out and distributed. So it was a lot more than just about beer. It wasn't just about how beer could be brewed or when it could be brewed, although that was included. The book of law that was produced contained everything from how to dress game and prepare different animals for food, to the accounting of the church, how to dye your clothes, how to properly make a saddle, all these different things that were kind of, it was kind of like a giant guidebook for life back then. But and it wasn't even, the law itself wasn't even called the Reinheitsgebot until I think 1919 is the year that I've seen, when it was, that term was coined by a lawmaker, I think during a policy making session, and it was basically been used as marketing material decades after that. So, which as we know it now, the Reinheitsgebot is, you know, on labels and kind of a purity, traditional kind of thing. The actual title of the beer is called How Beer Shall Be Served and Brewed in Summer and Winter in the Countryside. So, not the sexiest of names, and you can probably see why they coined a different phrase for that. So overall, it covers, or at least did, covers the price of beer in summer and winter, which were different seasons, different prices. Covers barley, hops, and water, and it started to define what beer really was and what you could call beer, what beer was, what beer wasn't, what could be included in beer. And one of the most important aspects of the law actually had to do with pricing, because what does the government care about more than money? Well, more than money, they care about controlling the money. So that was a big part of the law, because, you know, government wants taxes and wants to control money in really whatever, I guess, form they can. So this isn't a new thing. This is a human tradition, governmental kind of thing. But also, it did have to do with some consumer protection stuff. And I think it's still considered to be the oldest consumer food protection law, or however you want to phrase that. There's something there. But back then, brewers would often put all kinds of weird shit into their beer, whether to change the flavor, to preserve it, to add a local touch, differentiate their beer from other people, you know, down the road or in the next town over. And often those things that they put in the beer were either just weird or disgusting or dangerous. Anything from the gallbladder of an ox to poppy seeds to hemp to pine soot to all kinds of herbs and spices that are not really fit for human consumption. So there was a beer quality and safety and healthfulness issue with the law, because you know, back then plain water itself was often contaminated with bacteria or microbes that were going to get you sick and maybe kill you until you boil that water and kill those organisms. So if you're going to boil the water, why not make beer out of it? Seems pretty straightforward to me. And a lot of people say that, you know, a thing that makes the rounds is that people made beer because it was safer than water. Well, making the beer itself, the boiling the water, or boiling the wort process of making the beer, is what sanitizes it. It's not the fact that it's beer. It's the fact of, you know, the steps along the way to make it beer that make it safe. It's not necessarily that it's beer that makes it safe. You could just boil the water and then have clean water. But, you know, extending that, why not make beer out of it? Going to all that trouble, get something better out of it. The Reinheitsgebot was actually not the first German beer purity law. It's kind of a tongue twister. There was one in Nuremberg in 1293, one in Munich in 1363. Later in Munich in 1447, they clarified and said only barley, hops, and water. Down the road in 1469, another version came into play in Regensburg. And in 1487, brewers in Munich were made to swear a public oath to the Munich law from 1447. So it was kind of a law, and then they, you know, further down made people swear a public oath to it if they were going to be producing beer. So another thing the Reinheitsgebot did, which was arguably the most important part of it, was saying that wheat could not be used for the brewing industry, because... Okay, so the AC kicked on, so it might have a little background noise at this point. But one of the things the Reinheitsgebot did was protect the wheat supply from the brewing industry. And that's because barley was better suited for brewing. Wheat was better suited for bread making. So it was kind of ensuring that people had food and, you know, not just beer. So that was one important thing that the Reinheitsgebot did. And at the end of the day, it was probably came down to keeping track of taxable money and income for the government. But that was an important part of it. That doesn't mean that wheat was not allowed to be used for beer at all, because, of course, someone could make money off it. So the ruler of Bavaria did allow wheat eventually to be used in beer making, but only by specific selection by the ruler of Bavaria, which I can't remember who that was at this point in time. I think it was in the 17th century that wheat was allowed into beer making. And remember, this isn't the entire, what we currently know as Germany. This was a different place back then. So different, a little different geographical lines. But so wheat was banned as an ingredient in beer until the government decided that some breweries could use it selectively. And then it became a select group of people that got a little bigger. And then they realized that, you know, taxes could be made and money could be made. So all of a sudden it's an important source of tax revenue for the government. It's funny how that worked out. No one sees anything like that anymore in our world today. You know, you can't use wheat to brew beer. Okay, now you can use it, but only if you pay taxes on it, and I get to choose who it is because I'm in charge. Where have we seen that? Anyway, if you've ever had a Schneider Weiss beer, you already know something about the modifications allowed and made to the Reinheitsgebot. As George Schneider pushed for the ability to use wheat in beer, which at, you know, up until that was a right only granted by the royal family, but he pushed for a more public application and a more public use. So things started changing. And Schneider Weiss is a very important company in the German wheat beer world, and has been for quite some time. So down the road, updates were made to the Reinheitsgebot. You know, things were changed, things were added. Yeast was included in the updated version in 1551. They still didn't understand all the intense scientific complexities of yeast, as they didn't have labs and all the scientific research that we do have today. I still don't think that everyone understands fully what yeast does today in all its complexities, but you know, now we have yeast banks, we have suppliers that you can buy yeast from, you can buy dry yeast, you can cultivate your own yeast, although there were kind of yeast banks back then, basically just considered to have been people responsible for keeping basically yeast available through the summer and ready for the next fall brewing season. They were hefeners, or probably more correctly, hefeners, which the book by Mark Drudge about lager points out that you might recognize that name as Hugh Hefner, Playboy, but I don't think he's ever harvested yeast. So yeah, there were kind of yeast banks, but yeast wasn't fully understood in the way that we understand it now. But it was understood. It wasn't excluded from the Reinheitsgebot, as I mentioned, because they didn't know what it was, because they did understand that it played a role. And like I said, some think it wasn't considered an ingredient because it settled out of the beer, which is not entirely true. But, I mean, look at a, you know, unfiltered German wheat beer. You've got a lot of particulate in there, which a good amount of that is from yeast. But like with anything else in beer, you know, you can argue this way or that way, and at some point probably going to have a point to make. Another important thing that the Reinheitsgebot did was kind of formalize brewing seasons, because over time people realized that when beer was brewed in the cooler months and allowed to age, and lager, you know, keep cool in cellars with ice, for longer periods, it tasted better. And a beer that was brewed in the summer, called Summer Beer, S-O-M-M-E-R, those beers spoiled very quickly, and it was not considered nearly as desirable as winter beer, and that has to do with the temperature thing, as so often does with fermentation in beer. Temperature is very important. So they discovered that pretty quickly, that winter beer, or beer that was brewed in the cooler months in the winter and before it got to the hot summer months, that kind of beer was a lot more desirable. Another more modern, if you will, adaptation came in 1987 when a European Court of Justice, I can't remember, something like that, a European court deemed that Germany couldn't limit other countries exporting beer into Germany based on the Reinheitsgebot, as it was ruled an unfair restriction on free trade. So that meant other countries could send non-Reinheitsgebot beer into Germany and still call it beer, but German brewers were still bound by the Reinheitsgebot since it was a German law. So a brewery in England or France or Czech Republic or Belgium or really anywhere else could brew beer not according to the Reinheitsgebot and send it to Germany and still call it beer because it was a German law, not a, you know, French law or English law or whatever. So it was kind of a interesting conundrum, I guess, that Germany kind of put itself in when it came to that. So they couldn't restrict which beers came in or out based on ingredients and based on the Reinheitsgebot because they couldn't hold other countries to that law within the German border since it wasn't brewed in Germany. So it kind of hamstrung their own brewers in a way in the creativity aspect because other breweries were a lot more free to do different things or play with different things if they wanted to. So kind of an interesting conundrum there. And then even more recently, 2005, a ruling was made that beer could be brewed with other ingredients outside the limits of the Reinheitsgebot, water, malt, hops, and yeast. But it, as long as it wasn't called beer, you could put other things in there, which is kind of weird that you would make beer and then not be able to call it beer. But there are plenty of beers brewed with wheat, which was not specifically included in the Reinheitsgebot. But that was mostly malted wheat, which was the more traditional way. And unmalted wheat was, and I guess is, kind of looked down on by purists. So if you're going to use wheat in a German beer, which, you know, wheat beers, Berliner Weiss, Goza, apparently unmalted wheat is not the way to go. So when you start your brewery in Germany, keep that in mind. So fast forward to today. What is the Reinheitsgebot today? It's still in place, although as we've discussed for the last 15 minutes or whatever it's been, things have changed. And, you know, as in all things, things change with time and progress and get modified for a whole boatload of reasons. But essentially today, the Reinheitsgebot is a labeling and marketing tool. It's still in force. You can, you know, you can call something a Reinheitsgebot compliant beer or Reinheitsgebot beer or brewed to the Reinheitsgebot tradition. You know, you see it 1,000 different ways on labels, but however you want to phrase that, it's essentially been kind of relegated to a marketing tool. It's still important. It's still, like, you can't erase the importance that it has had on brewing in Germany and really around the world. In other countries, Reinheitsgebot beers are a thing or were a thing and influenced tradition and, you know, in countries all over the world. But, I mean, it still has meaning, but, you know, like a few hundred years ago, today no one will be getting their beer barrels, quote-unquote, removed from their possession by punishment of law, by brewing a beer that's not considered good quality or doesn't brew to the Reinheitsgebot tradition. So, yeah, there's a you know, that's a kind of a sampler on the Reinheitsgebot. You can really dive into it. Some the books that I referenced for putting this together, as I've mentioned several times, The Beer Bible by Jeff Allworth. A new one that I'm almost done with that I really enjoy is called A Brief History of Lager by Mark Dredge. And, of course, the Oxford Companion to Beer, edited by Garrett Oliver and contributed to by, I think, 150-plus different contributors. So, you know, you want just a quickie, Google it, look it up in a book, go on Wikipedia, not always the best resource, but there's a lot of information out there. So this is just kind of a down and dirty basics, but I hope you enjoyed this one. I enjoyed doing the research, and you know, I always think I know something about a topic and then kind of dive into it and really learn more just by researching more about it and trying to put together something like this. So yeah, again, hope you enjoyed it. If you are enjoying this series, I know that the Beer Basics episodes aren't as popular as the interview episodes, but frankly, I can't get an interview every week. Hopefully in the future I can kind of get a more consistent flow, but new interview next week, that is coming, I promise. And you won't have 3 weeks in a row again of listening to me just drone on about shit. But if you're enjoying the show, follow it on Instagram, beertruth.podcast. Go to beertruth.com. Working on getting some more writing and blog pieces up there. And you can like the show on Facebook. And the most important thing that helps me is rating and reviewing the show on whatever platform you're on, or following on Instagram, which helps build the following. And it really does make a difference. I've said it before, but it makes a difference. People seeing the following and either not replying to me or kind of being half interested, or places that are really interested in being on the show, that really does make a difference. So I appreciate all that, all the support. And yeah, I'll try and get it together by Wednesday of next week, but it might be Thursday again. So until the next interview and the next round, thanks for listening and cheers.